This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think there's a good case to be made that people should be in control of this technology, because all these LLMs, all these machine learning models, they're learning using the sum output of humanity. You know, they've taken all the stuff we've created over years, and these companies are taking all that and using it to train their models. Well, then we should have a share of that, right? We should be profiting off of that as well.
If you listened to last week's Sea Change Radio, then you've already learned a little something about congressional hopeful Shoikhat Chakrabarty. Otherwise, you may not have ever heard of the guy. He's running to fill Nancy Pelosi's soon-to-be-vacated congressional seat here in San Francisco. In this second half of our discussion, listeners will hear about several ways that Chakrabarty and Pelosi differ beyond their respective levels of name recognition. We look at several of Chakrabarty's exciting ideas, including ways tech could actually help remedy inequality rather than widening income and wealth gaps, elements of the Green New Deal that could help curb profligate energy use by data centers, and the notion of banning stock trading among members of Congress. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Shoikhat Chakrabarty. He is running for Congress in California's 11th District. Shoikhat, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Alex.
Filling Nancy Pelosi's beautiful designer shoes in Congress is not an easy thing. She's been a very effective leader, first woman Speaker of the House, but she's also a controversial figure because anybody who's gained power in the Democratic Party is an easy target for the right. I think the biggest complaint against Pelosi from the right is her stock trading, that she accumulated a lot of wealth while in power. Whether this is because of her inside knowledge of how Congress works or business works is probably not the truth, because I think her husband was quite wealthy. But you have a substantial portfolio yourself, and you are pushing for a stock trading moratorium if you get elected. Why don't you expand and explain your personal journey with wealth and how you think it should be implemented in Congress?
Yeah, you know, I mentioned earlier that I worked in tech when I first came out to San Francisco, and I ended up joining this company called Stripe as its second engineer. And part of what actually politically radicalized me was that experience, because Stripe ended up kind of blowing up and becoming this multi-billion dollar company. And me, by virtue of just being in the right place at the right time, I ended up making a decent amount of money off of that. And
more than a decent amount of money.
Yeah, more than a decent amount of money. And that, you know, and that was really a crazy experience, because I didn't come from money, you know, and I grew up middle class in Texas, but my parents actually grew up quite poor in India. My dad was a refugee during partition. And so he grew up with his family of 12 in like a one bedroom apartment, often having no idea where his next meal would come from. And that was sort of the values I grew up with. But going from that life to all of a sudden having a lot of money, it was really radicalizing, because I worked hard, sure, for a few years at Stripe, but I didn't work harder than a teacher or a nurse or the people cleaning our offices did every single day. And yet they will never be able to afford a home or secure retirement in San Francisco. And that to me is a crazy economy. Like, that sort of lottery system for our economy, that is an existential threat to our country. Because I think if we can't create a nation where people can just work 40 hours a week and afford a life, I think we're doomed as a country. And that was frankly a big part of what led me to quit the tech industry and try to figure out what the actual answers to that larger problem should be.
It almost sounds like the American dream that you benefited from, in many ways, you were able to look at it as a nightmare through clear-eyed lenses.
You know, it's funny. I think what I experience is a warped version of what the American dream should be. The American dream to me is what my dad experienced. My dad, you know, as I mentioned, he was poor in India, but he managed to come to the U.S. because he got a visa. And at the time, the way my dad got here, it was actually because America was this growing, you know, optimistic country. We had had decades, it was in the 60s and 70s, we had decades of income growth and living standards going up. We just put a man on the moon, built the interstate highway system. And we actually had these immigration offices all over the world that were recruiting millions and millions of people to come. And so my dad's friend like took him to one of these offices in Calcutta, and the staffer like pitched him on the American dream and tried to, you know, got him to apply for a visa right there on the spot. And to me, the American dream was, we are going to try to expand economic opportunity to as many people as possible. Right. That's what my dad benefited from. He came here and on a single income, he was able to create a middle class life for me and my family. And our goal was to create that opportunity for as many people as possible. Whereas now, what I think this warped version of the American dream is, we're going to create a lottery system where a few people in society can have everything while everybody else is just going to struggle to barely hang on. I think that's bass ackwards. So getting to stock trading. So first off, I said, you know, if I'm elected to Congress, I'm going to put all my assets in a blind trust. I'm going to have nothing to do with any stock trading, because I don't even think it's about whether or not people are directly benefiting from their positions in Congress. And I think a lot of people are. But when it comes to Speaker Pelosi, I don't know if she was trading stocks internally or not. What I do know is like right now, people in America have lost complete faith in their Congress and their institutions and government. And things like the congressional stock trading lead to that that sort of decline in faith in our institutions. And it lets someone like Trump come in and say, I'm going to drain the swamp, right?
Or it can lead to the young being lackadaisical about getting out to the polls.
Yeah, it's people see the political system as being completely rigged. And they're not wrong to feel that way. And I think people in D.C., like the big mistake that I think Speaker Pelosi made is discounting this movement for a congressional stock trading ban. She's now come out in support of it. But back in 2018, when I was there, she really fought hard to keep that from happening. And people in D.C. don't realize how deep the distrust in government has become outside the Beltway, just how nihilistic everybody has become, just how much everybody believes that if you're wealthy and you're powerful and you're a politician, the rules don't apply to you, right? And that has got to end if we want to make the pitch of using government to do good things for people's lives, which is what we as Democrats want to do, right? So we have to do it.
Yes. In a similar vein, I saw that Mike Levin, a congressman in Southern California, has a new presidential pardon bill where he's trying to change business as usual with that. And we've seen these pardons become a transactional farce at this point. Something like that seems far overdue. Assuming that the Democrats take back the House in 2026, a lot of their work will be trying to just undo a lot of the harm that's been done just in this last year alone, which is frightening when you look at the list. The to-do list is vast. But presidential pardons, that seems like low-hanging fruit, but it might not be as easy as we think.
Yeah, you know, I think we definitely need to curb the abuse of presidential pardons. But I really think the job in front of Democrats going into 2028 is not just going to be undoing damage. I think we have to really go beyond that to kind of rethinking from the ground up. Like, if we want to renew our systems, our institutions, our, you know, the way we think about our economy, what does that look like? Because to some extent, part of the reason why Trump got elected and why he's been successful is a lot of the institutions we had, they were better than not having them, but they were faulty, right? And I think, we didn't make a case to the American people for why they deserve to exist. You know, things like USAID, things like our national, you know, science research grants, things like that were easy for Trump and them and his cronies to cut, and with very minimal public backlash. And I think we actually need to go into 2028 and really put the country into this mission of rebuilding people's means of making a living and rebuild our institutions in that frame. So we're actually getting public buy-in for why we need all these agencies in our government, why we need these institutions. And let's build them better. You know, let's actually make them so that we fix all the problems that the old ones had. Because everyone working in those institutions, people who've gotten science and research grants, they all tell you there were plenty of problems in the old institutions, right? And similarly, when it comes to sort of separation of powers and sort of democracy reform, yeah, there's ways we could be doing things better than we have. And we've just been eroding it for a long time. And I'd say both Democratic and Republican presidents have for years been eroding the power of Congress and putting more and more power into the hands of the executive. And I'm thinking of things like the AUMF, which allows the executive branch to just do unilateral military strikes, basically take us into war. Tons of stuff like that have been abused by both sides. And Trump's just kind of supercharging it all now, right? And I think we've got to have a hard break.
Cause you close the door and left me here blinded by the light. Don't let the sun go down on me, although I search myself, always somebody else I see. If you just allow a fragment of your life to wander free, cause I'm telling you that losing everything, it's like the sun going down on me.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Shoykat Chakrabarty. He's running for California's 11th district. I saw your town hall where a lot of the discussion went back to AI. We're in San Francisco, so that's not surprising. But you have a unique perspective as a software engineer, former software engineer, and someone who really understands tech. Speak to how tech might be able to help with inequality, because I think those are two things that you know a lot about.
Yeah. You know, when I look at something like AI, right, I think this is, it's not exactly a tech question. I think the larger question is who gets to decide what the future of our society is? Because AI right now, it could be used to wipe out millions of jobs. I mean, the tech leaders are saying it might even wipe out humanity. I don't know if I believe that, but I mean, that seems scary if it's possibly true. And so why is it the case that a handful of CEOs get to decide to do that kind of change to our society on their own? I think that makes no sense. I think the fundamental question with something like AI and with tech at large is, shouldn't we as a people get to decide how this technology gets introduced in our society? I mean, something like the productivity gains from AI should be leading us to talking about 4-day or 3-day work weeks, right? It should be talking to, we should be talking about dramatically increasing the wages of working people because all of a sudden they can do way more with way less time. But that's not going to happen with the current way we have this stuff set up. You know, that's going to require us as a nation, you know, us using the government as, you know, the representative of the people, deciding the future of this stuff. And so one example I gave, I think, in that town hall was about how automation car manufacturing came into being both in America and in Germany. And in Germany, their auto manufacturers, they have corporations, labor, and government that all sit on the boards of their car manufacturers. And they make these industrial plans, they have 5-10 year plans. And the result of that was after about 10 years, German car workers were making double the wages of their American counterparts. They were also making more cars per capita than in America. And they actually had more automation in car manufacturing than in America. So I think that, could, you know, these technologies could be used to dramatically reduce inequality, increase the wages of working people. But that's not going to be what Sam Altman does on his own.
Yes, and I can't help but think of the way our market forces have created this mess, and it well precedes AI. I'm old enough to remember the transition from the manual typewriter to the electric typewriter to the word processor. And throughout all of those revolutionary changes in the office space, secretaries, their salaries didn't go through the roof. They were not given less work days. They weren't able to just come in 3 days and do all their typing. They were probably a lot more productive because they could hammer out all of these things that took a lot longer to type out in 1950 than in 1990, but their salaries never went up. And yet, look at the CEO class. C-level executives' pay has just skyrocketed since 1970. It's just an exponential growth. So it seems like there's more fundamental problems at play than just AI.
Yeah, I mean, one way to think about it is right now there's all this private capital being poured into AI development. I think something like, I saw something like 40% of our GDP growth right now is being accountable to AI, right? And that's not AI making money, that's just like money going to building AI data centers and AI capital expenditures. And you got to ask yourself, why would private capitalists, you know, private shareholders pour all this money into this technology? And the answer for them is there's a potential to remove labor, right? There's a potential to get rid of all the workers. And so you'd have this huge return back to the shareholder class. And I think when you have an economy that's entirely being driven by private capital like that, that's going to be the incentive. The force is always going to be, how do we get a higher return back to the shareholders? And that's not going to be possible if we're talking about increasing the wages of workers. So I think a fundamental shift we have to have is driving these technologies using public capital, where the goal is not just profit for shareholders, but the goal is something else for society, is for people.
Yes, and I keep going back to, I'm fascinated by autonomous vehicles, and that's an AI technology. And you see, it's not very popular. We see these ghost cabs driving around San Francisco, and everybody I see on the in my neighborhood is just clucking at them and saying it's not happening. It's just this change that is obviously happening is something that's not, the human brain can't really fathom it yet. But this transition is happening. When you look at how deep the pockets are of the companies that are invested in autonomous vehicles, and yet I've done pieces on SeaChange Radio where we talk about how this can really be a helpful technology. Like, it's not going to be all bad because cab drivers and truck drivers may lose their jobs. There can be real benefits for the disabled, people in rural America. It can help mass transit if it's done correctly, and we shuttle people to those last miles to BART and the metro stations. There's a hunger for regulation and a hunger to keep the status quo, while also not necessarily looking long term at, and I think that's where investors benefit, is they are looking at what you're explaining, this reality of being able to replace old jobs with a computer that can do the same thing as a human.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of it does boil down to control. Like right now, like people, just like everyday people, feel completely out of control of their futures and their destinies, right? And that's because that's true. Like this technology right now is just being driven by investors and CEOs, and they're just deciding everything for you. And so you take something like autonomous vehicles. Yeah, you know, if we actually had publicly available autonomous vehicles, and we had the ability to like plan this transition, so it's not just this chaotic, you know, bomb that gets dropped and all of a sudden a million jobs get wiped out, then I think we would feel a bit more security. Because I actually think we have to get beyond this idea of just regulating it to think about, okay, let's actually plan out how we want it to happen. Because if we just regulate it, I don't think that's going to be sufficient. You know, I think the companies are going to figure out ways around it. It might slow it down a little bit, but it's really just kicking the can down the road. I think it's fundamentally shifting who gets to decide. And I think there's a good case to be made that people should be in control of this technology, because all these LLMs, all these machine learning models, they're learning using the sum output of humanity. You know, they've taken all the stuff we've created over years, and these companies are taking all that and using it to train their models. Well, then we should have a share of that, right? We should be profiting off of that as well.
I think that's right. If we can have a collaborative process between government and market forces, that seems to be one that is popular in and successful in Scandinavian countries, for example. But keeping on the AI path for another second, speak towards the enormous energy consumption that AI data centers are using, and how that could maybe be a way to curb some of the proliferation in this area. We did a piece on SeaChange Radio about regulating leaf blowers. And instead of going to the environmental side of things, that was a federal issue, but you could talk to your local politicians or your local communities could enforce and curb leaf blowers based on noise pollution. So it was kind of a workaround. It wasn't the most direct way to curb it, but it was very successful. And so you see like over 500 towns around the country have put in these leaf blower bands based on the decibel levels. Sorry, that's kind of a tangent, but can we use the elements of a Green New Deal in helping to harness the AI boom?
So basically, the basic idea is when a data center plops down in a community, it just requires tons of energy. And right now, there's no requirements for those data centers to bring on their own energy. So it just makes everyone else's bills go up, right? Like, it's just sucking up all this energy, and everyone else has to pay more for their bills. And I think, like, we should be looking at that energy demand as a way to actually build out our clean energy and require these AI companies who have tons and tons of money to not just bring their own clean energy to power their data centers, but to provide excess energy for the communities and use that as a way to start building out a whole supply chain of things like solar panels, wind farms, all the stuff we need to build that energy in America, which is what the Green New Deal is trying to do through this larger project of, you know, let's set the country on a mission for just building a clean economy. The data centers alone won't fully do it, but that, you know, could be a way we sort of bootstrap all these industries that we need in the U.S. But right now, it's just happening in this chaotic, completely unplanned way that's driving everyone's energy costs up. Well, it could happen in a more planned way where the data centers are bearing the cost of this energy transition and is driving people's energy costs down.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to Shoykat Chakrabarty. He's running for California's 11th district. So maybe you can tie that into any kind of ways to implement better economic indicators beyond just growth, because we are in this endless growth mindset, which is not a sustainable one. And we've seen, like, the Global Happiness Index, yeah, for example. Are there other ways besides GDP and the Dow Jones Index for America to gauge how well we're doing as an economy and as a society?
Yeah. You know, I am a big believer that it's not just indicators, but we should have goals as a country. You know, one easy one is we should have a goal to have a completely emission-free economy, right? And that's a goal that we have to target, and we have to have milestones to getting there, and we have to actually have a plan to getting there. It's not just, you know, let's create some tax incentives, let's create some subsidies, create some policies, and then hope our economy gets there. We actually have to have a government that's proactively driving us towards that goal. And, you know, I think other goals could be, if we look at AI, okay, how do we actually drive adoption of AI in our society in a way that increases people's wages, increases leisure time, reduces reduces people's daily anxieties, and then let's drive towards those goals. Like, that's the way I think we need to be thinking about society overall. And it's not a very weird way to think about stuff. It's how we used to think about our society back in the day. It's the way a lot of countries think about how to develop their economies and their nations today. I mean, it's weirdly a thing that is very popular to do when you're a developing nation, but somehow when you become a quote-unquote rich country like America, we decide, we don't actually need any more goals anymore as a nation, let's just let profit drive everything. But there's other countries that don't do that, actually. And you mentioned, you know, they'll have other indicators for how they measure the health of the society, but I think it's beyond just the indicators. We actually need to have specific goals that we're driving towards.
How can people get involved in your campaign? Why don't you give us all the ways that people can reach out and connect with you?
Sure. So you can find me on social media anywhere if you're interested in more of these ideas, but definitely go to my website. It's shoikat.us, S-A-I-K-A-T.us. If you live in San Francisco, I do a call with voters every single day at noon. You can join one of those, or usually like 5 to 10 people, very small group settings. I answer all questions that you can possibly ask me. But we're also running a huge grassroots volunteer-driven campaign. We've got, you know, I mentioned over 2,000 volunteers so far, knocked on hundreds of thousands, over 100,000 doors. So please sign up to volunteer and show up to one of our canvases or show up to our office, and I'd love to see you there.
Well, good luck with the campaign. Shoikat Chakrabarty, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
While we have a few extra minutes on this week's show, I wanted to read an excerpt from a piece by Adam Serwer in The Atlantic discussing the presence of ICE in Minneapolis and the brutal killings of Renee Good and Alex Preddy that were captured on video and horrified millions. The title of the piece is Minnesota Proved MAGA Wrong: The Pushback Against ICE Exposed a Series of Mistaken Assumptions. The federal agents sent to Minnesota wear body armor and masks and bear long guns and sidearms. But their skittishness and brutality are qualities associated with fear, not resolve. It takes far more courage to stare down the barrel of a gun while you're armed with only a whistle and a phone than it does to point a gun at an unarmed protester. Every social theory undergirding Trumpism has been broken on the steel of Minnesota resolve. The multiracial community in Minneapolis was supposed to shatter. It did not. It held until Greg Bovino was forced out of the Twin Cities with his long coat between his legs. The secret fear of the morally depraved is that virtue is actually common, and that they're the ones who are alone. In Minnesota, all of the ideological cornerstones of MAGA have been proved false at once. Minnesotans, not the armed thugs of ICE and the Border Patrol, are brave. Minnesotans have shown that their community is socially cohesive because of its diversity and not in spite of it. Minnesotans have found and loved one another in a world atomized by social media, where empty men have tried to fill their lonely soul with lies about their own inherent superiority. Minnesotans have preserved everything worthwhile about, quote, Western civilization, while armed brutes try to tear it down by force. No matter how many more armed men Trump sends to impose his will on the people of Minnesota, all he can do is accentuate their valor. No application of armed violence can make the men with guns as heroic as the people who choose to stand in their path with empty hands in defense of their neighbors. These agents and the president who sent them are no one's heroes, no one's saviors. Just men with guns who have to hide their faces to shoot a mom in the face and a nurse in the back.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Amnesty, Betty Levette, and Simond.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.